The next case on our calendar is case number 822-0611, State of Minnesota versus Stephanie Louise Clark. Counsel, while you are getting ready, welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This is Wednesday, January 18th, 2023. We have six cases on our calendar for today. This is the third of four that are set for oral argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial opening arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and then after that, 5 minutes for rebuttal. If you choose to have rebuttal arguments, when you approach the podium, there is a button underneath to raise and lower the podium as you see fit. There is also a time clock up there to watch to see how much time you have. Make sure you monitor that appropriately so you know when your time is running out. And with that, counsel, you may proceed. And counsel, please state your name for the record and the party you are representing.
Good morning. My name is Caitlin Rose Fisher, and I represent the appellant Stephanie Clark. This is a case of undisputed domestic violence, and the importance of the particularized circumstances surrounding that domestic abuse to Ms. Clark's claim of self-defense. Now, the sole issue at trial was whether Ms. Clark feared imminent death or great bodily harm when she shot and killed her abuser, Don Juan Butler. And with respect to that sole issue, the Minnesota Supreme Court has long recognized that the fact that Ms. Clark was a victim of domestic violence at Mr. Butler's hands is relevant, extremely relevant. Yet in its rulings below, the district court repeatedly eviscerated the relevance of Mr. Butler's undisputed abuse, abuse that even included, at one time, holding a gun to the back of Ms. Clark's head and cocking the hammer. That history of abuse mattered, and it should have been fairly presented to the jury that decided whether Ms. Clark did not commit a crime because she acted in self-defense. Now today, I'd like to start and focus my time on the issue of the erroneous jury instruction that conflated an imminent harm standard with an immediate harm standard. And then if time permits, I'm planning on addressing the erroneous admission of Andrew Madison's testimony, planning on resting on our briefs for the issue of the sentencing testimony, although I'm of course happy to answer any questions that the court might have. So turning to the jury instruction issue, I'd actually like to start with the facts because I think they are incredibly important to everything else that follows. And focusing on the undisputed and the disputed facts.
Well, counsel, I appreciate the fact that you want to get into the facts, but we are familiar with the record. Mm-hmm. I think really what you are arguing on appeal, from my understanding, is a legal issue of the legal interpretation of a jury instruction and whether imminent is the same thing as something that occurs immediately. And you know what that definition means. So
I agree, Your Honor, that is the legal question, but the Minnesota Supreme Court has for a very long time said that self-defense, especially when it comes to jury instructions, has to be particularized to the facts of the case. Said that in State v. Hare, State v. Bjork. So I think it's not possible to look at whether the instruction was accurate without also looking at what the facts are in the case. In fact, I think that that's the very analysis that the Minnesota Supreme Court went through in Richardson. And so if I may, and I'll keep it brief, but just turning to some of the undisputed facts, I don't think it's not disputed that Ms. Clark was a victim of domestic abuse. There was, apart from her testimony, evidence of physical intimidation all around that apartment, a phone that was smashed to pieces. There's a picture of that in the addendum at page 50. Cupboards that had been kicked in and broken. Those are at the addendum on page 38, 41. There's, of course, the physical abuse, the bruising on her body, and the size difference. Now, turning to the disputed facts, One of those questions, there are three questions that I'd like to direct the court's attention to. And one of those is, could Ms. Clark have left? And I think that this bears directly, Judge Reyes, to your question about whether this was an erroneous instruction. Could she have left instead of firing that firearm? And on that, I think a jury could have concluded no. All right, there was expert testimony that said often it's dangerous to leave. Women don't leave abusive relationships. She testified and actually said in her initial statement to law enforcement that she believed that if she were to leave, Mr. Butler would have stopped her. He had threatened to kill her and her family. So could she have left? Now, there are two other factual... Oh, yes, Your Honor.
Yes, I'd like to ask about whether she could have left. Could she have left after the initial round of shots that she fired when he was on the ground and not have gone to get the other gun and fired the additional rounds, including the ones that went, the shots to his head, which were indicated to be the fatal shots?
Yes, Your Honor. That actually goes to the second two factual points I wanted to address. So the first is, what happens when she fires the 22? And I won't get into that because I take it from Your Honor's question that you're most curious about what is the circumstance when Ms. Clark fires the 38? There, I think it is absolutely disputed that Mr. Butler was lying on the floor, that he was immobilized. I direct the court to Dr. Middleton's testimony, the medical examiner. He testified that all of the bullets from the 22 were, quote, skin deep, soft tissue. They don't hit any organs. They don't hit any bones. They're not disabling. And where did Mr. Butler go after Ms. Clark started firing the 22? He ran down the hallway, and he went to a room that contained five loaded firearms, all right, including one on the bed that he's on, at least one on the bed. And there's also record evidence that he was moving over the bed and toward a cupboard that was found pulled out that contained a fifth loaded firearm, a governor, Smith & Wesson governor. And that, again, if you look at pictures from the night of, the cupboard that the governor was in is pulled out, it is chipped, and that's where he's moving. There is no evidence that he was disabled, that he was on, or certainly not undisputed evidence, that Mr. Butler was disabled and lying on the ground. In fact, again, the state's evidence that all of the shots from the 22 were skin deep and not immobilizing proves completely the opposite. Now,
but go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead. Mm-hmm. My question is
whether she had an obligation to leave under Minnesota self-defense law since she was in her own home.
She absolutely did not. There was no duty for her to retreat. And that, tying back to the second factual point that I wanted to address, this is what happens at the moment she fires the 22. All right, she's in a home. She's got a small boy feet away. And there's an angry man that has threatened to break her ribs that night, that is acting completely differently than he ever has before, right? That has been punching her, leaving physical bruises, and that is pacing back and forth to a room with five loaded firearms. And again, who's much larger than her, who could have very easily stopped her from moving. Now, I've spent a lot of time talking about the facts, so I do want to tie this back in, Judge Reyes, to your question about how those particularized facts impact the jury instruction. And the question is, given that those particularized circumstances, was it error to instruct the jury that imminent harm requires that harm or death will occur immediately in this unique case of domestic violence? And the answer is absolutely. And it's because it obliterated the history of abuse. And starting with the law on this, I think it's important, start with the statute, as this court always does. Minnesota Statute 609.065. The word immediate is nowhere in that statute. Not even the word imminent is. It says, is the use of force necessary in order to prevent death or in order to prevent an offense that the actor reasonably believes exposes that person to death or great bodily harm. Now, case law, of course, expands on what that necessary requirement means, and case law does say that, yes, in order for a threat of harm or the use of force to be necessary, the harm has to be imminent. We don't disagree with that. But when it comes to what does that mean? What does imminence mean? Minnesota case law instructs, and I think this is in Boyce, in other cases, that there are two questions. What is the danger, and what are the alternatives? And the jury instructions have to be narrowly tailored to that danger and those alternatives. And turning to the context of domestic abuse, you know, this court doesn't have to write on a blank slate. The Minnesota Supreme Court has said that the danger that is presented by persistent violence and abuse and intimidation, that matters when it comes to what the danger is. And also, when what are the alternatives? Can someone leave to respond to that question? Domestic abuse and history of domestic abuse also impacts that. Is it safe to leave? Again, we've cited testimony in our briefing, and expert witness Melissa Skaya testified to the same thing. The moment when it is most dangerous to a victim of domestic violence is when they are leaving. Remember, Ms. Clark, her family's three blocks away. What's going to happen when she goes those three blocks? So again, the danger, chronic abuse, threats, intimidation, alternatives. Is it safe to leave? And often for victims of domestic violence, it's not.
What about calling the police? What about getting an order for protection? When we're talking about alternatives, aren't there other ones as well?
Your Honor, I think that's a jury question. And again, I'd go back to what is
okay,
the...
Okay, if that's a jury question, then that's a different issue then of the instruction of what is the meaning of imminent. And you've conceded that imminent is a requirement for there to be a finding there. In other words, I think your question still, the issue still boils down to what is the meaning of imminent? And is imminent the same as immediate, which is what case law seems to equate it with?
So I strongly disagree that case law equates imminent with immediate. I think that the only place where you can potentially find that in Minnesota precedent is Peterson versus Lang, which is just an incredibly different context. And I think it's important in that case, what the court was analyzing. So first of all, civil case, not self-defense, not where we have direction from the Minnesota Supreme Court that the jury instructions have to be particularized to the facts and circumstances of the case. But there, the court is analyzing... underlying statutory language is whether there was an approximate hazard from a car collision. And I'm not disputing that in some cases, like in the instance of a car collision, when you have someone going down a road, they're moving already, there might not be much daylight between imminent and immediate. But there certainly are cases where there is significant daylight between those terms, and I think that this is one of those cases. I direct the court to State v. Hunley, the Kansas Supreme Court case. I think that really clearly explains why domestic violence is the precise situation where there is a difference between imminent and immediate, and a part of it is that essentially there is this pattern of unpredictable and chronic abuse. And the question is, how long do you make the victim wait, right? Does Ms. Clark have to wait until he's pointing a gun, until she's effectively unable to protect herself? That's not what the law is. And I think a hypothetical is helpful, and this actually comes from the Bechtel decision. There, the court... It analogized the situation of a victim of domestic violence to a hostage. So imagine you're a hostage. You look at the clock, or there's someone who's holding you hostage. They've got a gun on the table, and they say, you know, it's 2 o'clock right now. When that clock strikes 10, I'm going to shoot you, and I'm going to kill you execution style. All right? That threat of harm, it's not immediate. They say 8 hours until I shoot and kill you. That's not an immediate harm, but... is that harm imminent? A question of danger and alternatives. What is the danger? That you're going to be killed. What are the alternatives? You're stuck in a room. And so if between those 8 hours, there's an opportunity to grab that gun and shoot and protect yourself, I think that is well within the cornerstone of self-defense law. That is a case where there's a difference between imminent and immediate. And domestic violence is not that far different, all right? It is... And to go to your question,
well,
Judge,
but you're really arguing by analogy, but isn't that what the district court did as well by looking at the Peterson case, also looking at the Boyce case, which was and looking at the criminal sexual conduct jury instructions as well, to try to define what is meant by imminent, and seeing that imminent and immediate are being used as synonyms of each other. So it's not like the district court just pulled a term out of nowhere. Even Black's Dictionary defines imminent as a danger that is immediate. So I mean, isn't there a basis for that interpretation?
I don't think so, because again, going back to Minnesota precedent, jury instructions have to be particularized to the fact of the case. And an immediate harm standard is not particularized to domestic violence.
They do, but we also give broad discretion to the district court to tailor the jury instructions as well.
Yes, but that discretion is abused when the district court misstates the law. And jury instructions can misstate the law, absolutely.
They can, but how is it a misstatement of the law when the district court is, in fact, relying on other cases? Just as you've analogized a hypothetical, that's what the district court did as well. So why is that an abuse of the district court's discretion?
I think it's an abuse of discretion because instructing on immediate is not particularized to domestic violence. I'm trying to directly answer your question, but I think there's a bit of, you know, I think it's notable that since Peterson was published in 1953, that language has never been cited in a self-defense case by the Minnesota Supreme Court. It has never made its way into the jury instructions for self-defense. And even the one court of appeals case that kind of lumped onto that language and applied it in a criminal sexual abuse context, well, first of all, it's not self-defense, so you don't have this requirement that the instructions be particularized to the case. But even more so, that wasn't even a case about jury instructions. That was a case about sufficiency. So I think that the district court's decision was contrary to the law, and it was not supported by Minnesota law. And with that, I see that I'm out of time, so I'll look forward to seeing you on rebuttal.
Thank you, and you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you'll have 15 minutes as well. Please state your name for the record and the party you are representing.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Peter Marker for the state of Minnesota. If I may just have a minute to begin where counsel began with the facts. I think there are some very important key facts here. And I don't know how disputed they are. It is a fact that the defendant followed the victim down the hallway as he was pacing. And she shot him in the back with 8 projectiles, or in the side and the back with 8 projectiles. Those were not skin-deep projectiles, as counsel suggests. One of them was two of them were through and through. They came out of his face, went in through his shoulder and came out of his face. Two of them went into his chest wall. Two of them went into his lower back. Hardly skin-deep. He was unarmed. That's another fact. And that is the defendant's own police statement, that he did not have a gun on him and he was not at the moment threatening her. And the other key fact is that he was incapacitated. Those are the defendant's own words during her police statement, that she stated that he was staggering when she shot him, that he was on the floor, that he didn't have a gun. I was just pointing the gun at his head. When I shot him in the head, I just didn't want him to suffer anymore. I wanted him to stop talking. I figured he was already dead, and I just didn't want him to suffer. I shot him in the head once or twice. So these are key facts, and her statement to the police hours after the shooting is supported by the forensic, the medical examiner's testimony, which states that he did have 8 projectile back to front trajectory from when she shot him in the hallway in the bedroom, and then at least 2 top down larger caliber bullet trajectories through the top of his head from close range. And I submit to you that he was incapacitated when he received those shots. And this goes to the question of reasonableness, as we argue in our brief, because, of course, reasonableness is going to overlay everything that we discuss here, as the case law that we cite establishes.
So and he was much taller than her, are you saying that the medical examiner's report indicates that the last two shot, that he was lying on the ground when he was shot then?
It indicates...
Could he still have been standing when she shot him in the head?
Oh, I don't think that inference is a reasonable one, Your Honor, that he was standing. I mean, I think it indicates that he was shot in the top of the head with a downward trajectory. And he had another bullet wound through the top of his, through his head as well. So he was either sitting against the wall or lying on the ground. But it, I think it's plain. And also, from frankly, from the defendant's own police statement, she said he was lying on the floor when she shot him with the higher caliber bullets. So the state would ask the court to keep those facts in mind when it's evaluating these questions, because that is so important. Counsel?
Is it clear where he was when she fired the first shots?
Well, Your Honor, by her statement, as I understand the record, he's walking, he's pacing back and forth between the kitchen and the bedroom. I don't know what the distance is there.
Is that a hallway or just an opening?
My understanding is that it's a hallway. And my understanding is that he tends to be a pacer when he's up, when he's upset. That's the defendant's statement to police. And that at the time that she, at one point while he's moving away from her, she follows him and shoots him. That's her statement.
Does this hallway go to anywhere else other than the kitchen?
Well, my understanding of the record is that he is walking towards the bedroom at that time.
I see.
And so...
So when she delivers the first shots, he's still in the hallway, he's not in the bedroom?
That's how I would interpret her statement. Again, that's derived from her own police statement, the night of the shooting. And then, the defendant states that she shoots all four rounds, which is eight bullets, a double-barreled .22 caliber revolver. All eight bullets back to back to back to back with four rounds. She empties that gun, and my understanding is that he is now in the bedroom, suffering greatly, and ends up on the floor, at which point she finishes him off with the .38 caliber.
Record reflect how many other firearms are in the bedroom?
Well, there's firearms all over the house. There are at least a couple in the bedroom. Yes. Whether he was going for one of those, we'll never know. And I think that evidence, was before
well
the jury.
They were all loaded?
I think every gun in the house was loaded. It's my understanding of the record. So, again, now, I want to get to the question of immediacy versus imminence, because the question is a narrow one for this court. Did Judge Cahill materially misstate the law in choosing to expand on the instruction that the jury had been given through his initial instructions?
Do you accept the proposition that at some occasions imminent and immediate might be the same and some occasions it might not?
I certainly align myself with the proposition that reasonable minds can disagree about that.
That wasn't my question.
Well, they may have different meanings
my
in certain circumstances.
May be appropriate to it on some cases, under some circumstances and some facts, for the trial judge to tell the jury that in this case, immediacy is the same as imminent. But in some other case, it might be inappropriate for the trial judge to say that.
Perhaps.
You subscribe to that?
Perhaps. So
then we need to look in this case, under the facts of this case, whether or not that instruction was a fair and accurate statement of the law of imminence.
Well, I think that we don't want to ask trial courts to prejudge the facts too much when making that determination. And that would be my concern there.
I don't mean for the judge to have to say to the jury in this case, but for the trial judge to decide whether to give the instruction that was given here to take a look at whether or not it's appropriate in the facts of this case as opposed to some other case.
And, Your Honor, I would submit to you that Judge Cahill did that here. I mean, this was a considered decision.
Well, as I understand it, there was some discussion between counsel as to how the judge ought to remedy the situation. And there were some other suggestions, some other alternatives to the one that he gave, the one that he used.
It's almost always an alternative to leave the instruction as it is. Judge Cahill wanted to address the question directly. That's reflected in the record.
Record reflect what other suggestions there were other than this one?
I think the other suggestion on the table was to simply not expand on it at all, which also would have been within the trial court's discretion.
And it's not uncommon for district courts to say, you know, the instruction is what it is. That's up to the jury to figure out what is meant by immediate.
Certainly not uncommon, Your Honor. And this...
Your common sense.
And use your common sense. I think that didn't happen here, for Judge Cahill felt the need to instruct further for whatever reason, maybe because of the nature of that word. I don't know. That's not clear on the record. But he chose a word that the Minnesota Supreme Court has said means immediate. In this particular circumstance, no. But the Supreme Court has said that imminent means immediate.
In a civil case.
In a civil case that this court has subsequently adopted in a criminal sexual assault case, non-precedential.
In a non-precedential decision.
Non-precedential. In a criminal sexual assault case that has nearly identical language to the self-defense statute.
So I'm just, so here's where I struggle with the state's argument, and that is with the Supreme Court's decision in State v. Harvey, where the defendant thought that the victim had a gun in his pocket, and that was sufficient. How is that an immediate threat of harm as opposed to an imminent threat of harm, as appellant is describing it, that there would be it soon, but it's not going to happen at exactly this moment, which is, I think, the argument that the appellant is making.
Sure. Well...
Because you don't disagree that some intervening steps would have to happen if, in fact, the victim in that case had a gun in his pocket.
I would say at the outset that the Harvey court did not discuss this distinction between imminent and immediate. And that simply was not a discussion in that case. But, I mean, that was a sufficiency of the evidence case. And the facts are slightly more involved. The defendant does think that the third party has a gun. The third party is leading the defendant's brother out of a bedroom after having heard what he believes to be a chamber racked inside the gun. And the brother is making a facial gesture towards the defendant that he's in trouble. And so I believe the Supreme Court's holding in Harvey on those facts was that... that was...
The state hadn't sustained its burden to overcome the defendant's defense justification.
Right. And so there's a question there as to imminence, but that was for the jury in that case.
But why wasn't the question of imminence before the jury here? I mean, that's... I guess this goes to a question that I have, which is, what's our standard of review when... We're talking about there was a set of jury instructions, a question comes back from the jury, and the district court decides to answer that question when it very well is an open question in the state what the meaning of that word is. How do we review under that, you know, when that's our procedural posture?
Yes, Your Honor, you review it for an abuse of discretion. Trial court has discretion to fashion jury instructions. The question for this court, more specifically, is whether or not the instruction that was given materially misstates the law. Doesn't materially misstate the law. And with the backdrop of the law that we have, I submit to you that the answer is no. This court should not say that Judge Cahill materially misstated the law when the Minnesota Supreme Court has said that imminent means immediate. And when that has been
in the context of a civil case, an automobile accident,
which has been adopted by this court and subsequently put into the jury instructions.
You aren't troubled at all by taking an instruction or taking a definition of imminent from a civil case involving automobile accidents and just without anything more applying it to a self-defense instruction with domestic abuse? You don't see it as a distinction?
I do see the distinction, Your Honor.
And you don't think it's a meaningful enough distinction that you ought not rely upon it?
No, I do think it's meaningful because this court has relied upon it. This court relied upon it in its subsequent decision on a criminal sexual assault case. Where
in a non-precedential decision, which this panel is not bound by.
But which is now in the jury instructions for that criminal sexual assault.
But that's a criminal sexual assault jury instruction. And two, even if that was the same jury instruction as here, a jury instruction can be held to be contrary to law and a misstatement. And we have, in fact, reversed those. But my question is, and I agree with you that the standard here is an abuse of discretion, but a district court can abuse its discretion by material misstating law, and I agree with you on that as well. My concern is, wasn't the instruction, it really wasn't a jury instruction in a way, it was really a clarification of the jury instruction. Did the district court abuse its discretion by clarifying the jury instruction and providing an additional instruction of equating imminent to mean such harm will occur immediately? And by doing that, did it narrow the definition of imminent in this particular case under these particular facts where you do have a situation of domestic abuse?
I'm out of time, Your Honor, but just briefly. Yeah.
You may go ahead and answer.
I would submit that the answer to your question is no, the way it's presented, because trial court had some discretion there within the confines of materiality, of misstating the law, had discretion there. It's clearly within the trial court's ability to expand on instruction. Criminal rules say that. This court has said that.
I have one more question, if I might.
Yes.
You don't think there's a difference in terms of temporalness, a timing between immediate and imminent?
Do I think there is?
Yes.
I think reasonable minds can disagree as to whether. I think there can be under certain circumstances. The question here is whether or not Judge Cahill materially misstated the law and given the definition that he gave. And I submit to you that he didn't, respectfully. And I ask that you affirm the conviction. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you. I'd like to make three brief points. First, I'd like to start with why this was a material misstatement of the law. And I think effectively what the state's argument requires is that Mr. Butler have been holding a gun in his hand, not just that he was walking back toward a bedroom with 5 guns or it had threatened to break Ms. Clark's ribs that night. And that just isn't consistent with Minnesota law. It's not consistent with Harvey, as Judge Larson pointed out. It's also not consistent with State v. Richardson, which is a case that the state actually heavily relies on. That is a sufficiency case, but the Supreme Court said in that case the jury could have gone either way, even though the decedent was unarmed, right? The jury could have come out a different way. And again, it's a different context. It's a sufficiency case. But the Supreme Court recognized that you don't have to be armed in order to have a fear of imminent harm, of imminent death or great bodily harm.
Can I ask a quick question? What is your position on how we review a material misstatement if the law If the law is not clear, if the Supreme Court hasn't decided what the meaning of the word imminent is, what's our standard of review for what is a material misstatement versus some other kind of misstatement of the law?
So I think it would still be an abuse of discretion. And here, I guess I would just come back to saying, I think that there are always gray areas in the law. It is frequently the case, I mean, especially if a case gets to trial, that probably means that there isn't a case on all fours. And so just because there's a gray area, then you go back to the higher level principle. Was this particularized to the facts of this case? The Minnesota Supreme Court has recognized that you don't have to be armed. And of course, the Minnesota Supreme Court has recognized that domestic violence, a history of persistent abuse, is relevant to whether someone fears imminent death or great bodily harm.
Does it concern you at all that witness Madison and his describing self-defense references immediate?
Yeah, I think that just shows a part of the error in admitting his testimony. And a problem with his testimony is that it just wasn't particularized to self-defense. Or, to Judge Larson's question earlier, it wasn't particularized to the home setting. In fact, one of the things that he instructed on was that there's a duty to retreat, which obviously wasn't applicable. And frankly, it's not too surprising, because that was a conceal and carry course that concerned how to carry in public. Judge Klaphock, I would like to return to a few of your record-related questions that the state answered and with which I disagree. So first of all, on the issue of whether Mr. Butler was disabled when Ms. Clark fired the .22, I would direct the court to medical examiner Middleton's testimony. He says, quote, "All the wounds were survivable except for the head injury. That one would have been immediately incapacitating. The others, literally, were skin deep." That's in the fifth transcript,
page 218. That doesn't necessarily mean, even if they were survivable, that means that the victim could have survived, but that doesn't mean the same thing as being incapacitated or that the person was on the ground.
And I think that the jury could have decided either way on those issues, Your Honor.
But on appeal, we have to give deference to the jury and assume facts in favor of the jury's guilty verdict.
If this were a sufficiency issue, the question is whether about the jury instructions and whether if the jury had been properly instructed, it would have reached the same decision. I mean, I heard counsel for the state say that we don't know whether Mr. Butler was reaching for a gun. That's right. We don't. There was one gun on the bed. There was another one on the table beside. The jury could have decided either way. But what it did is the agency was taken away from it by Judge Cahill's instruction that there had to have been an immediate threat. Judge Klaphock, to your question about the hallway, it is a very short and narrow hallway. There is a picture of it in the record. We have a picture of it. It's at the addendum at page 39 at exhibit 47. There were 5 firearms all loaded in that fifth bedroom. The district court, when it comes to considering alternative instructions, it considered instructing on the necessary standard from Boyce. So it did consider alternatives. And of course, counsel for Ms. Clark asked that if the parties couldn't reach agreement, that the jury just be told to go and use its common sense and the definitions that were provided. I'd like to come back to, and I know I'm almost out of time, but what could she do? All right, she's got a large man who has threatened to break her ribs that night. She didn't think she could leave, and she thought she was going to die. And she thought that her young son, she says immediately, if I go, who's going to protect him?
Was it that same evening when he held the gun to her head?
She did testify that he held a gun to her head, but in her initial statement to law enforcement, she described it at an earlier occasion. Your Honor, if there was any case where the immediate or the particularized circumstances require that a jury not be instructed that imminent harm means immediate, it is this case. This was erroneous and prejudicial error in this particularized circumstance of domestic abuse. We ask that you reverse and remand for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both, counsel, for your briefing on this and your arguments. Both of them were very well done. We appreciate that. We will be issuing an opinion in this case within the 90-day statutory timeframe. Thank you both.